Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. I'm on a telephone, so I apologize for the lack of audio quality, not the same as if you're in front of a microphone. But I'm going to be sharing a lot today on health and healing, so I'm going to go through a lot of different studies. Then I got feedback on Charlie Rose's interview on 60 Minutes last night with the Emir of Qatar, where six or more nations are now boycotting in the Middle East Qatar. And they say because they're supporting terrorism. Charlie Rose did the interview, and from what I can understand, at no point did he look at the countries claiming that they were engaged in, that Qatar was engaged in terrorism, about their own background. In point of fact, every one of those countries has engaged in terrorism, supporting al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, and the destabilization of Gaddafi. In fact, Qatar was responsible for that. So I'm going to have Abby Martin do a short commentary upon we learn nothing about the Arab Spring. In fact, remember this, please, that that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama fully supported the governments, not the people. It was only after it was clear that the governments were falling, then only then did they support it. Our entire neocon community, all those neoliberals in Washington, they supported Egypt and Mubarak. They supported the governments against the people. So we're going to have a little commentary on that. Then we're going to have a discussion, an in-depth discussion, about a half-hour discussion with Professor Michael Hodson. He's been known as the people's professor. I mean, he is right there with Joseph Stiglitz. He's one of the best economists in the world. But he also is like Gerald Salante. Gerald is extremely accurate and his insight is very prescient when it comes to predicting where we're going. And he's going to give us his input on this new tax plan that passed it was 50-50, and then the Vice President Pence broke the tie, meaning it defended banks, it defended hedge funds, it defended billionaires, it defended corrupt corporations, and they're the only ones who are going to benefit from this. So Michael and I have a discussion on America's future trend. I will simply let this part be known now. Michael believes that we are going to go into an extremely deep depression, not a recession, but a slow one. It'll take about 2 years to unwind different parts of our economy where the bubbles start bursting, but it's not going to be a giant burst. It'll be a slow leak. But the end result will be the same for the average person. If you think it's bad now, this is nothing compared to how bad it's going to be. Unemployment is also, and we've also taken into consideration what about the artificial intelligence, the visa program, the outsourcing of jobs, robotics, taking over assembly lines. Well, where exactly does that leave the average person? Well, it depends upon your background and whether or not you own a company or whether you just work in one, and how essential is that to outsourcing, privatization. So we can look realistically at about a 30% loss of jobs over the next 5 years. That's minimum. That means that for the first time in American history, since statistics have been kept, the vast majority of Americans, probably upwards of 150 million Americans who could work, have work, will not be working. Now, of course, based upon the corruption of the American media and the corruption of our government, we'll probably be told we have 1% unemployment. The fact that we are the ones responsible for accepting their lies should be of concern. So that's a conversation you won't want to miss. That's coming up. Let's begin on health and healing. The first study is from Science Daily, and it's reported in the peer-reviewed journal Circulation, Cardiovascular Quality and Outcomes. What it shows is that African Americans with heart disease who simply practiced meditation required about 48% less medications and had less heart disease, less heart attacks, less strokes. In fact, they were less likely by nearly 50% to die of all causes compared with African Americans who attended a health education class over more than 5 years. So one attended classes, one group, and the other engaged in meditation. The meditation group was the one that benefited. Now, this is particularly important to me because I just completed, just finished the last people left yesterday after being spending a month with me. And the reason I did this, and please understand, I won't be doing this again. A lot of people were flooded. My office just in New York was inundated with calls. Oh, you know, I got this, I got that. I want to attend the next month. No. What I did was this. Instead of doing a health support group that I normally would do, I've done them in Washington, I've done them in Los Angeles, and most of them in New York, where you take a group of people with a specific condition. Let's say it's arthritis. And for 28 days, the selected group, selected meaning they have to have had arthritis, they have to have been on medications, had been diagnosed for at least 7 years. That way, it's not just, well, I just got arthritis. Well, how do you know what the cause is? I don't. How do you know it's arthritis? Well, I'm not sure. No, these were all under rheumatologist care, taking meds. And for 28 days, they radically changed their lifestyle. No medicines involved. And then we did an analysis. We had all their medical workup at the beginning and at the end, and we had a huge, like 85% improvement across the board, some reversing arthritis completely. We did a 3-month, 6-month, and a year follow-up. They kept that health. Then you send that out. You have your statistics done, and you get it published, and hopefully that contributes to other people saying, hey, if that person did it, maybe we could do it. Because imagine how much better we'd be off if in this country if we realized with just lifestyle, behavior, and diet modification, we could overcome, reverse, or improve on conditions that otherwise are debilitating and lessen the quality of life. Now, I've done it with stroke. I've done it with high blood pressure, with obesity. But the last one was depression and anxiety, 93% recovery from depression and anxiety with no meds, all off all meds, and a one-year follow-up, improving even more. And that's the key. What happens if you get results when people are coming every week and then they go, they stop the study, and now they don't have any place to go, and they relapse back. So it's that non-relapse factor that's important, and it has to help people cross all boundaries. You have to have people from all ages, all walks of life, all ethnicities, all cultures. So it's very complex to do a study. But then I wanted to see, what if you had people who didn't come once a week for a month to a two-hour meeting, but were in a place 24/7. They couldn't watch television because there's no television. I haven't seen a television, read a newspaper in 10 weeks. In fact, I didn't have electricity for 3 weeks. In fact, even today I don't have electricity when I just got back home. And because of the storm, and it's being fixed by electricians, but that's why I'm on the phone. But imagine then that you're able to see a person where they're not just absorbing information, but they have a chance to talk about their life, how they got to where they're at, and using standards that can be treated, but the best medicine can do is slow down progression in some cases, never halt it, and certainly never reverse it, where there are no cures, like multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's, as some examples. Or in a 78-year-old woman, debilitating thinning of the bone, osteoporosis, and arthritis, so bad a person couldn't walk without a cane. A month later, the person's walking 2 miles, no cane, and has more energy they have, and most importantly, no pain. Well, that's something that doesn't happen unless you're in a controlled environment. So the idea was, if it works for conditions that historically you can't reverse, and you reverse them. Now you follow up. You follow up like this week, everyone's getting medical tests done, especially with the end-stage lung cancer metastasize, and where the oncologist will determine what are the blood markers, what was impacted, is there a statistical significant difference? That is important, but then some of these will take a year before we get the final results. But it's like, here's why this is done. This is why I agreed to sacrifice a lot of income, because October's my lecture month, where I'm book solid lecturing, which is one of the ways I'm able to do the charity work I do, because I have to earn money someplace to pay for the documentaries and the radio show and the PRN and all the other things that I do not ask the public for a penny from. I just do it myself. But I gave that up for these people, because like Bannister and the 4-minute mile, every scientist, every engineer, every expert had written that it was not possible, not humanly possible, for a body to run faster than a 4-minute mile. And then he did it. He did 3:58. Very shortly thereafter, I believe it was the next 2 weeks, several other people did that also. Well, the question is, A, they were all wrong now, and he was right, and that set a whole new paradigm of what was possible. And B, why did those other people then break it after he proved it? Well, they were waiting for proving. Paradigms shift only when there is a proof by a new paradigm that is possible. Now, there's a lot of politics, a lot of economics involved between proving something is better and getting those who have a vested interest financially and politically and ideologically to change. Generally, in the United States, it takes about 37 years after medicine has been proven doing something absolutely wrong, hurting or killing people, ineffective, toxic, then they finally change. But they will never change on a dime. It just doesn't happen. And for the reasons I suggested. So now we have a lot of proof that conditions, post-traumatic stress disorder for 50 years, with no quality of life, in constant pain, argumentative, depressed, is now normal, positive, all behind. Same way with a lot of other conditions. So for those, please don't be called my office, because that was merely a way of proving what could be done. Now then, we're going to publish this, and then it's up for other people in the field to use this information, include the full protocols, so that if people want to, nutritionists, dietitians, health counselor, wellness counselor, lifestyle counselors, holistic nurses, naturopaths, homeopaths, herbalists, anyone who works on a regular basis with people who has not had the results they had hoped for, at least you'll have, with these people and their conditions, you'll have a new template to use, a new paradigm, because it worked. In fact, one of the people who came down there was a former 10-year now recovered person with multiple sclerosis, totally cured. And that's, boy, that got someone's attention. One of the people there with multiple sclerosis who had some wonderful things to say. In any case, one of the basis of all the retreats I do is to help people get to a place where they can be relaxed in their conscious thoughts. For that, you have to have meditation. For that, you have to have silence. For a lot of people, they'd rather pull a tooth out without Novocaine with a pair of pliers than to be silent for more than 3.5 seconds at a time. They just can't. In the process of them continuing to feed that hyper-angst, that hyper-agitation, that constant need to talk, to chatter, what they're also doing is they're not allowing their innate healing ability to manifest. They can show up someplace, but what tools are you willing to surrender and what tools are you willing to implement in any environment that you go into? It's like every student that goes into a class is not always prepared, desiring, or is motivated enough or disciplined enough to learn the lessons that the teacher is willing to present, especially when there's so many more exciting things outside of that classroom or on the internet, and they can sit there all day now in most, not all, schools, and it's irrelevant what the teacher's teaching. They're just sitting there, and they know they're going to graduate, and they know you can't keep anybody back. It's our whole corrupt system. And so we have functional literates, but they're, at least they're not made to feel uncomfortable about doing something like studying, where you're actually learning some critical thoughts. When they do study, it's always for the test, not for the underlying virtue of knowledge. But imagine what we would be as a different type of society if we actually meditated. Meditated with the purpose of bringing ourselves to a more insightful state of being, where we didn't have to overreact, we didn't have to walk around negative. So when they have a study showing, a good study, that African Americans with heart disease who practice meditation regularly were 48% less likely to have a heart attack or stroke or die from all other causes compared to African Americans who just attended health education classes, it's in the actualization that it matters, not just in the intellectualization. So you can think about something, but doing it is different. It's the doing that matters. And that's the big emphasis at all the retreats: silence, meditation, and come to grips with that inner healer inside all of us. So here's another point. And by the way, there are thousands of articles on this, on body-mind medicine. This is just an important one. Now imagine how many people, if they, instead of getting angry or rageful or depressed or anxious or walk around insecure, uncomfortable in their own being, imagine if they went to that more relaxing place of meditation, not only helping prevent disease, but manifesting healing. That's the importance of that study, and I just tied it in for the purpose of showing you why silence is so important. Remember, it's only the silent mind that can heal. I've never in my entire career been able to help someone get to that healing place if all they can do is process emotions and thoughts constantly through the epigenetic subconscious, because it's always going to win every battle. Your subconscious is far more powerful than your conscious until you master the conscious, then the conscious is more powerful. Now, Science Daily also offered an article published originally in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine that showed that exercise can extend our life. Good, but this is 150 minutes of exercise per week. That, to me, is about half what we should be doing, but okay, it's on the low end, and it's not strenuous, it's moderate. But here's what's important. Listen to what they say. It's a, quote, it can extend your lifespan by 5 years. 5 years by just exercising 150 minutes a week? What if we exercise 3 hours a week, which is, you know, more realistic, 3.5 hours? Could it then extend our life 10 years? It's worth considering. That's important. Vitamin K, that's a almost never discuss nutrient. You don't need much of it. But it cuts the risk of diabetes by over 50% in elderly people. So, by the way, vitamin K promotes the removal of calcium from the blood to prevent heart disease and diabetes. Quote, the results of this study show that dietary vitamin K is associated with a reduced risk of type 2 diabetes, which extends the potential roles of vitamin K in human health. You bet. So make sure you're getting your vitamin K each day. 1 milligram is plenty. L-arginine, A-R-G-I-N-E, nature's remedy for sexual dysfunction and stress. It's an amino acid and rarely taken. You almost never see people supplementing it. But why should you consider it? Arginine is a very pro-sexual nutrient. It really supports a healthy sex drive in both men and women. In any case, so arginine can do a lot of good inside the human body, and we rarely, it helps. In one Japanese study, it showed that if you're using it with lysine, L-Y-S-I-N-E, it can significantly decrease cortisol levels. That is important because when you have elevated cortisol levels, that means you're stressed, and that can create a heart attack when you're stressed and cortisol levels are increased. It can also help if you're losing muscle. It can help your body to do that. And if you produce too much cortisol, you frequently lose muscle mass. And it's a small amino acid. It functions as a natural growth hormone stimulator. So it can help body muscle. So if you're over the age of 45 and beginning to lose some of your muscle, arginine can make a difference. And it can improve blood flow to the genital area. It works as a natural treatment against erectile dysfunction. And in women, arginine has been shown to help improve sexual response, especially after menopause. And it also was found to reduce blood pressure in people suffering from hypertension. So where do you get your L-arginine? Well, you can take 1,000, 2,000 milligrams, but you can get it in oatmeal, cashews, pecans, coconut, seaweed, chickpeas, watermelon, lentils, and spinach. And it's one of the important nutrients that we can take into our body. And finally, a cup of green tea daily is shown to reduce the risk of this particular cancer by 24%. And there's so many good things green tea does, but it's rich in catechins, or healthful flavonoids, and these compounds have truly amazing benefits. From weight loss to brain protection and disease prevention, green tea is truly a healing powerhouse. And the benefits go on, with research connecting the tea to ovarian cancer treatment and prevention. Multiple studies have demonstrated the effectiveness of green tea in reducing cancer risk, and according to one study, one cup of green tea each day was able to reduce ovarian cancer risk by 24%. And more than one cup provided even more dramatic results. Two cups of green tea per day reduced the risk by 46%, and those women who drank green tea for over 30 years saw the rate of ovarian cancer drop a whopping 75%. We're not talking about any other nutrient now, just green tea. So how does it work? It's relatively simple. It creates programmed cell death in the cancer. And what happens is the components also downregulate the expression of proteins involved in inflammation and cell signaling and cell motility and angiogenesis. All those are what cause green tea to prevent cancer in your body. That's the latest in health and healing. Now we're going to take a break and come back with Abby Martin talking about the Middle East. Now, I'm sharing this with you today simply because everyone in the media, left and right, are refusing to call out United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and all Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait. Also, they, directly in the Middle East, but the United States, Great Britain, France, and Italy have also supported regime change, funding terrorism, and in fact, one particular email between Hillary Clinton and John Podesta, they're actually discussing the fact that Saudi Arabia was funding terrorists. And there are at least 20 major reports on this. This is not a secret. So the question is, why didn't Charlie Rose, on his 60 Minutes piece, why did he not, when sitting down with the emir or the ruler, a young guy, 37 years old, of Qatar, why didn't he mention the fact that you're being accused, Qatar, of funding terrorists, but the people accusing you are major funders of terrorists? He didn't. He made it seem as like this is the only problem of funding terrorism in the Middle East, Qatar, instead of everyone else. So it's just part of the hypocrisy of the mainstream media and the alternative media. Remember, the alternative media also tried to convince its own liberal base that the invasion of Gaddafi was a good thing in Libya, and that Assad was the bad thing and for the people, none of which was true. All the independent, truly honest reporters have shown that. But then again, there's a lot of dishonesty within the alternative media as well as the liberal media and the conservative media. Here's Abby Martin.
Of an internet film portraying the Prophet Muhammad in a derogatory and offensive way. Unsurprisingly, the prominent narrative resounding in the establishment following the wave of protests is of sweeping generalizations.
And you know why they hate us? Yeah, I talked to intelligence people all weekend. They hate us because of their religion. They hate us because of their culture, and they hate us because of peer pressure.
We are the spark. Our existence, our way of life is one long spark. They want to extinguish that spark. So we need to stop worrying about what sparks what and focus on protecting our citizens from this prehistoric evil. As Hillary Clinton said, these acts are confounding. True, it is confounding how unprotected our embassies are. What's not confounding are the attackers' motives. They hate us.
What kind of sense do you have about who exactly they are? Are they part of an organized group, or are they just young men looking for trouble?
By and large, they seem to be young men looking for trouble.
Really, Scarborough? And Fox, they don't want to extinguish our way of life. They just want us to stop extinguishing their lives. Have any of these news commentators read about the history of U.S. foreign policy and interventionism in these regions for the last century? The other resounding line in the media has been one of utter perplexity. How could they hate us when the U.S. has been helping to spread democracy to these very same countries? Check out this clip from NBC's Richard Engel reporting from Egypt.
It is somewhat ironic that it was American diplomats inside the embassy who helped to give these demonstrators, these protesters, a voice and allowed them to actually carry out this anti-American clashes that we're seeing right now.
So the U.S. gave a voice for protesters in Egypt. I think many would disagree with what Ingalls deems so ironic, considering how the U.S. is one of the biggest allies to the brutal dictator Hosni Mubarak for decades, giving him over $2 billion in foreign aid every year since 1979. The U.S. didn't take the line of the Egyptian revolution until it was already happening. Then, when the revolution was underway, Egyptians were brutalized, freed, with USA-made tear gas canisters by Mubarak's security forces. As Mike Preisner, Answer Coalition organizer, has so eloquently stated, he said, Muslims are not culturally backwards for attacking U.S. embassies. Americans are culturally backwards for not understanding why. Now, to think that the militant response is only due to an inflammatory film is extremely naive. Intense hostility toward the U.S. long predates this film, and the reasons are hardly difficult to recognize. Preisner goes on to explain in a recent editorial, these protests can only be understood by taking into account the historic role of imperialism, which has left a deep reservoir of anger toward the United States and other colonizers. Some of the actions have been the invasion of Iraq, support for brutal military dictatorships, arming and funding Israel for its nonstop war and occupation of the Palestinian people, notorious illegal torture and endless drone warfare, which targets civilians. Only by analyzing the backdrop of colonial violence in these regions can shed a light on how and why these things occur. But in large part, the historical and contextual amnesia of colonialism and imperialism is completely absent from the mainstream narratives. And these networks are just drooling at the mouth to be given a chance to push their familiar line of how evil and ungrateful these people are and how necessary the war on terror is to keep fighting. The commentators and politicians look at these protests unfolding and point to them as a sign of collapse and destabilization of their prehistoric societies. But interestingly, very similar things have been happening right here in the U.S. Check out some of the footage I got tear gassed multiple times for during the Occupy Oakland crackdowns late last year. Is it just me, or does this look familiar? You see, you can't forget the unrest brewing in our country, because we too have a breakdown in society, which will only get worse as the gap continues to widen between the rich and the poor. Yep, you don't see much attention paid to our police state, the spirit of revolt, and the instability here at home. And while corporate outlets have been all too focused on the unruly protests across the Middle East, the anniversary of Occupy Wall Street has sparked another wave of protests and militarized crackdowns in New York City, where, get this, 181 demonstrators have already been arrested, including many for simply filming or sitting. So, instead of focusing on how these Middle Eastern countries are falling apart at the seams because they're culturally backward, Maybe the establishment should look at the glaring fact that this country is falling apart at the seams as we speak. And maybe they should work to fix the innumerable wrongs plaguing the people who live here before it escalates to the point where the unrest can no longer be marginalized or ignored.
Abby Martin, now we're going to take a break and come back in a very interesting discussion that you have not heard in the mainstream media on why we should oppose this new reduced corporate tax bill. Please stay with us.
Welcome back, everyone. Joining me on the line right now is Professor Michael Hudson, considered the America populist economist. He cares about what happens in Washington and how it impacts us. And right now, though no one has read all of this proposed tax policy that they want to make into law, I want to start by sharing something from Bloomberg. Here's what it says. An article entitled, "The Real Winners in Trump's Tax Plan. Corporations and the Wealthy Would Come Out Ahead. Here's the Proof." And it goes on to say about corporate taxes. More than 70% of the corporate tax burden falls on American workers, according to a Congressional Budget Office analysis. Now, that analysis is important because what it means at the end of the day, someone has to pay taxes. Someone has to put money into the bank accounts of the federal government agencies so that we can continue having a society. On the one hand, we have the American Free Enterprise Institute, which is the bastion. That is the capital of the neocons, the people who want expanded war and who want the military-industrial complex to get the lion's share of everything. Currently, it does, about 56 to 57%. However, they're planning over the next 5 years to see that another $600 billion is added to our military defense budget. Where's that money supposed to come from? Who's supposed to pay for this? At the same time, they're saying, oh, we can cut Medicare, we can cut Medicaid, we can cut Social Security, we can cut back on municipal handouts. The American public is not up on economics. So what's going on in Washington will impact them. And to take us on a journey of finding out the mistakes we've made in the past, what we're doing now that is wrong, and the likely outcome of this is, as I mentioned, Professor Michael Hudson. In fact, Paul Craig Roberts recently called him the world's best economist. He's currently the president of the Institution for the Safety of Long-Term Economic Trends, and he also is the author of many important books, including Killing the Host, How Financial Parasites and Debt Bondage Destroy the Global Economy. And that addresses the cause and effect behind the polarization of the 1% versus the 99%. His website is michael-hudson.com. Nice to have you with us today, Michael.
It's good to be back here, Gary.
Michael, the GOP and Trump have allowed $1.5 trillion in tax reform called reconciliation that Republicans tried to use to pass a bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. The tax cut would add up to $1.5 trillion to the deficit over the coming decade. And the average person doesn't know what this means. But what it overall means is that in this United Tax Reform Framework, it would lower the top rate to 35%. It reduced corporate tax rates from 35 to 20%. It will allow one-time repatriation of corporate profits earned overseas. It doubles the standard deduction by eliminating personal exemptions. Trump's plan lowers the maximum tax rate for small businesses to 25%, including sole proprietorships and partnerships and S-corporations. Many are real estate companies, hedge funds, and private equity funds. And as a result, 85% of the tax cut only benefits the top 1% of earners. So that's where it gets bad. Now, it also eliminates the deductions for state and local taxes. That would hurt 40 million average people, primarily residents in high-tax states like California and New York State and New Jersey. And so we're not told that let us have a national debate. Let's televise it. People like yourself and others can be on one side of the issue and then bring their neocons forward on the other side and let the public see. Because sitting in the background, and then I'll have said my say, is Hartford, Connecticut, about to declare bankruptcy any day now. But look at the other bankrupt cities, San Bernardino, California, Stockton, California, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Jefferson County, Alabama, Detroit, Michigan, are just a few, and that is supposed to really take off once we start seeing the reality of the current corrections that will be happening, as you suggested, over the next 2 years, a slow correction, but nonetheless a substantial correction, where communities dry up, their bonds are not able to be repaid, much like Puerto Rico. So we might be seeing a miniature version, an isolated version of Puerto Rico simply having to declare bankruptcy on its debt, and that happening in states and cities around the United States, or at least cities around the United States. States can't declare bankruptcy. Cities, municipalities can. So take us through how we got into this mess where we're not all paying equal taxes, and even the richest people, even the major corporations, they rarely pay any taxes to begin with. Apple and Google, some of the biggest money makers, pay no taxes. And so why then would they need a tax break when they don't pay taxes to begin with? And yet the small person who can't afford a tax lawyer is always getting hit with whatever taxes can be extracted from them. The form is yours.
Well, I think you've summarized the whole thing, Gary. First of all, you've pointed out what's really pushing the deficit up, a vast expansion of military spending. And how are these going to be financed? Well, you're absolutely right. They're not going to be financed by taxing the 1%. Now, the whole principle of income taxation, since it was introduced in 1913, over a century ago, was progressive taxation. When the tax laws were originally enforced, only 1% of Americans actually had to pay taxes because they were the only people who qualified. And almost all of this income was the result of real estate and financial income. Well, what you have today is under Trump, and I'm sure it would have been the same under Hillary, is a direct inversion of this. Now the 1% that used to be the only group that paid taxes are the only group that does not have to pay taxes, like Amazon and the other groups that you said. The taxes have been shifted almost entirely on to the 99%, and this the Republican tax plan drives the nail into the coffin. It may be even worse than saying 85% of the tax cuts go to the 1%. It's almost the entirety of the tax cuts go to the 1% because the working class, the wage earners, and the middle class are probably going to actually have to pay more. And they're going to have to pay more not only directly to the government, because Trump has raised the tax rates that the lowest income earners have to pay, but as you quite correctly point out, this is going to throw state and local finances into even tighter fiscal crisis. And so what are they going to have to do? Either they join Hartford and Puerto Rico and declare bankruptcy themselves, or they raise the taxes. Now, the Republican plan is to applaud bankruptcy. The objective of this tax cut and tax plan isn't to finance the budget. It's to force cities and states into bankruptcy, whereby they do exactly what New York City had to do when it was insolvent in 1984, and that is they'll have to privatize. They will have to sell off public transportation, public real estate, the public domain, and what we're really in for is such a fiscal squeeze that now the privatizers and the hedge funds and Wall Street can come in and grab up these public assets that remain, bus systems, railroad systems, parks, and make a killing by buying it up for pennies on the dollar as a result of the crisis. So the purpose of the Republican tax cut isn't really to fund investment. There's not going to be a dollar of increased direct investment from this. It's to create a fiscal crisis that leads to privatization and a property grab by the hedge funds. It's a 1-2 punch.
That's exactly what happened in Puerto Rico.
Yeah,
they have triple tax exempt bonds, local, state, and federal. So hundreds of corporations piled into Puerto Rico. They had inexpensive labor. They did not have the environmental laws. They were met by some members of the Puerto Rican government who were working against the Puerto Rican people, unfortunately. And there was a massive, massive amount of money going into Puerto Rico. It did not go to the Puerto Ricans. It did not go for improving their quality of life, standard of living, or infrastructure. And I see the same thing happening here. I believe you're right on the button here in that if we really cared about taxing, we would say, first, shouldn't we have a discussion on where that tax money goes? And then show a large chart and show that healthcare, education, food programs are a tiny fraction, the largest fractions of that are over 57%, and that's to the military-industrial complex. But then the subsidies. We have this phenomenal cognitive disconnect. The corporate leaders, those ahead of the Free Enterprise Institute and the Cato Institute, they talk about, in the Business Roundtable, they talk about how we shouldn't be focused upon socializing. Virtually everything in that corporate enterprise is socialized. The roads that go to their factories, we the people pay for that. They didn't pay for that. The cleaning up their mess, they didn't pay for that. We the people pay for it. The pollution of rivers and streams and estuaries in the Gulf of Mexico, which is now one giant dead zone, we pay for that. They don't pay for that. And then you look at, we give them nothing but subsidies. Every single major corporation gets some form of subsidy. Now, go ask the average person, gee whiz, can I have a subsidy to help me? And suddenly they scream. So we have socialized the deficits for corporate America so they don't have to pay it. But we have purely a free market capitalist notion when it comes to we keep all the profits we make, but you share in our losses. The bail-in with banks, we bailed the banks out. Banks didn't help anyone. Not a single major bank said, you know something, we're going to put a moratorium on home foreclosures. It's not right. People have been paying their mortgage on time for the last 20 years, and they only have, 10 years to go on this mortgage, so let's give them a break. No, they went after, they bankrupted, or at least they foreclosed on all these homes. And if they really cared about everybody being covered by some form of bankruptcy, why didn't they allow any of the students in America who have student loans to be able to file bankruptcy? That they lobbied for, and they got. So if you're a student, you have compounding interest. You have a $30,000 student debt in 10 years. That's $70,000. So all this stinks. It stinks to high heaven, Michael, and I'm surprised that we've even allowed it to get this far without massive demonstrations, even a general strike, and close down Washington, close down the United States, and make it all. In fact, I just finished lecturing before a group, and I told the group, if you're poor, why haven't we had a real poor people's march, getting all the poor people together? Well, because they're poor and they're depressed and they don't have leadership. I said, that's nonsense. There are a lot of poor people who are working poor. In fact, the majority of poor people in the United States have one or even two jobs. There's even homeless people who are living in their cars or vans who still go to work each day. I said, we've created this self-imposed apathy that we, the people, don't have the organizational skills or the wherewithal to demonstrate against this capitalist system. And I say, yes, we do, and we should. Your thoughts?
Well, the basic impact of the Republican plan, as you pointed out with Puerto Rico, is to prevent any kind of democratic choice over how budgets are going to be spent. You remember when New York City, where we both live, went bankrupt, they took spending out of the hands of the government and put it in the financial management agency. When a city like Puerto Rico couldn't pay, they took domestic policy away from the government and put it in the hands of the financial managers. So the effect of the tax cuts is going to be to overcome democracy by taking choice over the budgets and putting it in the hands of financial managers, namely the hedge funds, that are then going to want to do the kind of insider dealings that are leading to the Puerto Rican electric utility, for instance, that they now want to privatize. The first thing the financial managers did in Puerto Rico was to cut back the maintenance of the electric utility, of cutting back the trees near the lines and the other things near the lines. So as soon as the hurricane came, it blew the trees into the lines because nobody had been trimming the trees. That caused all sorts of breakages. Same thing happened in California under PG&E that cut back the tree trimming. So you're going to have more and more cities, you mentioned Hartford, other cities, managed by financial review boards that are in charge of policy. This is the kind of thing that led to the fact that where I live in Queens in New York, the subways continually break down because the governor of New York, acting on behalf of really the Wall Street managers, have decided they want to build up the transportation near the high-income real estate areas, like the Upper East Side, 2nd Avenue, instead of fixing the switches in Queens. They want to build a big Wall Street financial center and trade center, $3 billion real estate project there, instead of spending the $1 billion on fixing the switches that lead to trains going on time. So if this tax plan really goes through and creates the kind of fiscal crisis we're talking about, you're going to have privatization of almost every kind of public utility there is, pennies on the dollar, and the financial management is going to squeeze out as much money as it can by cutting back services, by cutting back expenditure on maintenance, and taking the money and running. In fact, this is the great myth behind what Donald Trump is saying, that he's going to bring $4.5 trillion to America. The $4.5 trillion, or whatever he's he comes up with a different number all the time. You mentioned at the beginning of this talk, Amazon and the other companies that pay zero income tax. They pay zero income tax because they pretend to earn their money abroad, not in the United States. Now, Trump says we're going to bring back all these trillions of dollars, and it'll be invested. Well, first of all this money that they declare abroad is already in the United States. It's in the United States under, say, Amazon or Google's Irish affiliate, where they pretend to make the money, or Cayman Island affiliate or Panama affiliate or others. So the money's not a penny is going to come back to the United States. But what is going to be suddenly turned over to the head office of corporations that have been avoiding taxes in offshore banking centers, they're going to use this money not to build more factories, not to hire labor, but for stock buybacks, repurchases of their own stock to push up the price, and to pay out as dividends. So the whole and that's why the stock market's been going up. They're saying, aha, these tax breaks are going to enable companies, instead of paying the government, they're going to pay the stockholders. They're going to pay the bondholders. They're going to pay higher dividends. And there's no expectation at all that these companies are actually going to hire more people. So there's junk economics underlying the whole Republican plan. And, of course, they know very well what the companies are going to do, because that's what all the stock market reports are saying. This is a bonanza for Wall Street, and the people have no idea what's going to be hitting them in the face.
What is your solution?
The solution would be to go back to the way things were a century ago when they started the whole tax plan. The whole idea was to tax real estate and tax finance, to tax unearned income, to tax what used to be called the rentiers, the coupon clippers, the absentee owners, and instead of the middle class. You don't want to tax labor, and you don't want to untax real estate, because if you tax labor, you'll have to pay higher wages. The reason that there's not manufacturing in America is because American workers have to pay so much money to the banks to take out a mortgage for the home they live, because the land has been basically untaxed, and the banks are lending money against the land value that the government used to get. I know that's a difficult concept, but the whole tax system has made American labor priced out of the world market, and the financial system, financialization, means that the Americans have to pay so much money in debt service for the mortgage, for the student loans that you mentioned, for the credit cards, that even if they got all of their goods and services for nothing, just their debt service alone is higher than the wages for all labor abroad. So no wonder the Americans can't work in anything international except for arms sales, which are done to Saudi Arabia now and to other countries. That's the only kind of thing, monopoly, that America really can export. And it's basically a ongoing economic crisis that's going to get worse and worse in a slow crash.
Why cannot we as a nation have a civil and open conversation on the role of debt in our society? Because when you and I were growing up, very few people had debt, and what they did have was minor to their capacity to service it. Today, between a student who gets out of college, has a car, you have the debt on your credit card, on your student loan, on your car, and that's assuming you haven't had any money to buy anything beyond that. But that is going to mean debt peonage. You can't get out of that based upon the current economy unless you're in a very specialized field or have rich parents who picked up your expenses as you went. So the average American, according to the latest survey, cannot go 2 weeks without an income. They would have no cash.
Mm-hmm.
Over 70% of Americans do not have $10,000 in savings to their name. Now, that has historically been just the opposite. People were more conservative financially. They did not spend beyond their means. And today, the captains of industry have made it so industry to buy anything that you want, irrespective of your ability to pay, and actually hoping that you can't make your full monthly payment, because then they can take an interest from 18.6% up to 36% or higher. They make that big bonus when the money has cost them nothing, but it's costing you 38%. And based upon the nothing they got it for, that's a huge percentage of profit for them. Your thoughts, please.
Well, Gary, you say, why can't we have a civil conversation about debt? Well, you and I right now are having a civil conversation about debt. But the question is, why is it only on our channel where we're talking? Why isn't it on NPR? Why isn't it on NBC or CBS or any of these others? The mainstream media are really in league with Wall Street, and they don't want to talk about debt. It used to be that what people couldn't talk about was sex, and now what they can't talk about is debt. It's the one thing that's sort of missing from the media discussion. So the question is, how can we have the kind of discussion that you and I are having brought before the general public? I can't think of any way except what you're doing with your show. And it's just amazing that here we're having the discussion about what really ought to be the center of economics. But even I went all the way through a PhD in academia, and they didn't discuss debt. They never once pointed out that when they're talking about money, that money is debt, or that money's created by banks on their computers. It's not people's savings that are lent out. It's purely created money. Nobody's discussing how the economy really works. It's as if it's all become a mystery, and I can't think of any way to promote discussion except with you and a few other people.
Well, you always have a forum here, Michael.
Well, it's really good that you're bringing these issues before your audience, and I hope your audience continues to grow and talks to their friends about the issues that we're talking about.
Now is the time for all the people who are concerned about this enormous misdeed. It's devious. Call your legislator, write your legislator, and say you do not support this tax plan.
I think they'll have to give at least $1 million to the legislature in order for them to be listened to. Remember, the legislatures are all spending their time dialing for dollars, trying to fundraise. And they listen to the donors, to the contributors, and most of them are either in Wall Street or the military-industrial complex. So I'm not sure how much talking to them. I think the legislatures know what's going to happen, but they know which side their bread is buttered on.
Well, but we should remind them, if we don't have the money, we have the vote.
That's right.
And we won't forget this betrayal. Michael Hudson, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's really good to be here, Gary.
And that was a Newsmaker Update with Professor Michael Hudson on Trump's GOP tax plan following the Senate passing the $4 trillion budget bill. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day.